in the afternoon here on the East Coast of the United States. Colonel McGregor joins us now. Colonel, since we were last together, President Putin paid a visit, not to Crimea, but to the Donbas region and a couple of places around there. Americans weren't too happy about it. I thought it was a pretty good move on his part. What did you think?
Well, he went forward to where he thinks it's important that he be seen by his troops and by the Russian population. So it was a successful visit from my standpoint for him. I don't think he particularly cares what we think.
Well, I think you're probably right on that. Yesterday, there was some sort of a confrontation over the Baltic Sea, not the Black Sea, the Baltic Sea, between American aircraft and Russian aircraft. I'm surprised I didn't hear Lindsey Graham suggest that we should have shot the Russian aircraft down, but somehow it would have been immoral for them to have shot the American aircraft down. There was no shooting, but they were there. What were the Americans doing there? Why are we over the Baltic Sea?
Well, allegedly, I was told that two B-52s were practicing a cruise missile launch over the Baltic, obviously in the direction of St. Petersburg or Russia. Extremely ill-advised, in my view, and entirely unnecessary. The Russians, of course, were alarmed and sent up some fighter aircraft that effectively intercepted the two B-52s on the edge of the Russian air defense identification zone. The two B-52s changed course, veered off. The Russians landed. Nothing happened, fortunately. Why we chose this moment to conduct such an exercise over the Baltic is a mystery to me. It seems very stupid unless you're begging for escalation.
You know, you said they're B-52s. These are, my lay understanding, these are humongous, aren't they? They can carry almost anything.
Well, sure. They're long-range bombers, and they can launch cruise missiles from any location at a target that may be 100, 200 miles away. Again, why did they feel the necessity to do this in close proximity to Russia right over the Baltic Sea is beyond me. I don't understand it. I mean, if we think...
You said they were practicing. Surely they weren't shooting anything. The practice...
No. This was
something short of that.
Yeah, this. I'm told this was a practice run for the release of cruise missiles in the event of conflict. That's about it. I just question the wisdom of doing it, when they did it, and where they did it.
As we speak, President Xi of China is visiting President Putin in Moscow. President Xi very publicly suggested in the physical presence of President Putin that there be a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine. Now, I can't imagine Xi, who's the ultimate diplomat, would have made such an offering without President Putin, in President Putin's face, without President Putin knowing it was going to happen. Within a couple of minutes of this came the American response. Hang on to your seat, Colonel. Here's Admiral Kirby.
We'd be concerned if coming out of this meeting, there was some sort of call for a ceasefire. Because right now, while ceasefire sounds good, it actually ratifies Russia's gains on the ground. It actually serves Russia's purpose for a ceasefire to basically call a stop right now without any acknowledgement that Russia's illegally inside Ukraine.
So United States will be against the ceasefire because of this principal issue or because it was proposed by China?
I think I've been very clear. It's about the principle of a ceasefire called for right now, which would essentially just ratify Russia's gains.
Never mind all the bloodshed it would stop, Admiral Kirby. Never mind all the bleeding of cash and military equipment it would stop, Admiral Kirby. God forbid President Putin should smile over it. What did you think, Colonel?
When a great power like China offers anything resembling a peace plan that involves a ceasefire, our response should be we're taking it on board and we're going to examine it and we will respond after we've had a chance to examine it thoroughly. That's what a good diplomat would say. We have taken the position that the only arbiter in this operation is us. In other words, we're the only ones that can accept or reject any peace plan or ceasefire for Ukraine, which is utterly nonsensical. But this is what we've taken as a position from the very beginning, Judge.
Is this a manifestation of American exceptionalism, that everything that happens everywhere in the world has to be approved by us?
Well, that's not a tenet of American exceptionalism. That started with Madeleine Albright in her discussion with Colin Powell back in 1992, insisting that we are the indispensable nation, that nothing can happen anywhere on the planet without our participation. That was a very dumb observation because it's patently untrue. Most of what happens beyond our borders on any given day is completely irrelevant to the American people. But in this particular case, if we were interested in peace, and I think we've made it very clear that we're not, if we were, then we should have simply said, we'll examine the proposal. We'll study it and we'll respond. That costs you nothing to say that. And that's the diplomatic language that we should have used. The second part is that China is genuinely interested in bringing this war to a close. We need to get that through our heads. Everything that China is about is economic expansion, building prosperity. They want to build the One Belt, One Road that runs from the coast of China in the east on the Pacific all the way to Europe. To do that, you've got to cross through Central Asia and from Central Asia through Russia to Ukraine and through White Russia to Europe. They want that trade. The Europeans, by the way, would like to trade with China. Now, why do they want to go through Central Asia overland? Because right now they're heavily dependent for oil, gas, all the natural resources, minerals, food, on transport over the sea. Everything has to come out of East Africa, out of the Persian Gulf, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and Iran via ship through the Strait of Malacca up through the South China Sea to China's ports. That means that they are vulnerable for thousands of miles to what? It's called the United States Navy. And they don't want to be vulnerable to that anymore. They would like to avoid it. China is not a natural maritime power. I don't care how many ships they build. They know that.
So I'm going to conclude that Admiral Kirby, John Kirby, former admiral, who must understand what you just articulated, Colonel, is just a mouthpiece saying what his bosses in the Pentagon or the State Department, I don't remember who his bosses are. He works for the National Security Council, so I guess he works for Jake Sullivan. But what his bosses want him to say, which is the manifestation of this Joe Biden bellicosity.
Oh, of course. I think that's universally true. In fact, right now, I think you can say it applies to virtually all the retired 4 stars and 3 stars and the active duty 4 stars and 3 stars. I don't know of anybody who has voiced privately or publicly any opposition to the dumb policies. Now, I may be wrong and something has happened behind closed doors. I hope so. But no, I think that's true.
A little while ago, I don't know how President Putin knows this. I don't think the British announced it. I guess Russian intel told him. He said that British plans to deliver ammunition with depleted uranium to Ukraine would trigger a Russian response. That caused the press to ask the American Air Force general, who is a spokesperson for the Defense Department, this is a very short clip, if the U.S. would be delivering ammunition with depleted uranium. Before we get into what depleted uranium is and how dangerous this is and why Putin reacted the way he did, here's the U.S. Air Force general basically saying it's not coming from us.
They said that they were going to send munitions with depleted uranium. Is the U.S. sending any munitions with depleted uranium to Ukraine?
Yeah, so on your latter question, not to my knowledge, we are not.
What is ammunition with depleted uranium, Colonel?
Well, the ammunition that the Russians are referring to is tank ammunition, 120-millimeter smoothbore tank ammunition, what we call sabo rounds. These are the rounds designed for use against enemy tanks. And what happens is that we take depleted uranium, in other words, used plutonium, if you will, and we integrate that into the alloy that forms the penetrator on the ammunition, In other words, this long prong, which penetrates the enemy's armor, has right. this depleted uranium in it. It has an incendiary effect, which means that it causes anything inside the turret to essentially catch fire. So it not only increases the penetration capability, but it has the incendiary effect. Now, we use that on all the 120 millimeter smoothbore tank rounds that we built for the M1 series tanks. I use those in the Gulf War. They are ferocious. It sounds like a freight train headed down the track at 100 miles an hour when it leaves the barrel. It flies at more than a mile per second, and it effectively destroys anything that it touches. Now, the argument is being, since the Gulf War, does this depleted uranium cause damage to the population after the war is over? In other words, if you go into the damaged equipment or you encounter remnants of this ammunition anywhere, are you in danger of contracting cancer? Mm. I've heard arguments on both sides saying studies were performed that said no, other studies that say no, it's unclear, and then one or two out there that insist it's dangerous. But it is not a nuclear weapon, and people need to understand that. It has no nuclear capability, if you will. It's just a vastly improved penetrator that has the ability to be incendiary once it strikes the target.
I guess it sounds nuclear-like because of the phrase depleted uranium. And when I just saw this about 10 minutes before you and I came on, I thought, no wonder President Putin is so upset. Why is he so upset if this is ammunition with which he's familiar? Do the Russians have similar ammunition to put in their tanks?
Not that I'm aware. No, we're the ones that developed it. It's very good. It's very effective. I can attest to that personally. And as far as I can tell, no one has contracted cancer from being near it, around it, or having used it. And I certainly loaded rounds and spent a great deal of time around it. And I was also on the battlefield where we fought after the war and saw evidence for the damage it inflicted. I don't know what President Putin's information is. And the Russians are pretty sober-minded. And normally, I think if they knew what they were dealing with, they would not make these comments suggesting that this had quote-unquote nuclear implications. But perhaps they've decided that this has some propaganda value that harms us in the public eye. I have no idea.
If the British send this to Ukraine, does the Ukraine military have the tanks from which to propel this, or do they need different equipment? Or do they need Americans there again to show them how to use it?
Well, the smoothbore cannon, the 120 millimeter, is a Rheinmetall product. It's a German gun. The British use it. We use it. We and the British have both manufactured it under license. So it could conceivably be fired from a Leopard tank. It could be fired from a Challenger. And if someday M1 tanks arrive from the United States, it could obviously be fired through a 120 millimeter smoothbore cannon on an American tank.
Earlier today, I spoke with a mutual friend of ours, former CIA operative and iconoclast like you, Ray McGovern. And I asked him if the CIA is sick and tired of false information getting its way to the White House, or if the truth is finally making its way there. I think you'll find his answer, which is a little on the long side, but typically McGovern-esque. There's this little section where he imitates Lavrov speaking English with a Russian accent, as only McGovern can do. But I want you to listen to this. It's food for a lot of thought, Colonel.
Okay.
Are there realists in the CIA who can say, look, we're on the ground. Ukraine is not going to win this. Is this message getting to Lloyd Austin, Tony Blinken, and President Biden?
No. The CIA is totally corrupted. Lloyd Austin? He was guilty of fixing the intelligence on Syria. I mean, he was head of CENTCOM. 51 DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency analysts, complained formally to the IG at the Pentagon that he and his top coterie of officers were falsifying what they were saying about Syria. So there's no hope for Austin. With respect to Bill Burns, who I had initial hopes that he could stand up to these guys, forget about
it. That's the current head of the CIA.
Yeah, and he's now, you know, he was the guy that Sergei Lavrov, newly appointed in those days, foreign minister of Russia, he called Burns in and said, look, Mr. Burns, this is a red line. Nyet means nyet, no Ukraine in NATO. And he reported that. We have the cable. We have the cable because of WikiLeaks, all right? And if it's, you know, it's authentic. If I've seen one cable from Embassy Moscow, I've probably seen a couple thousand, okay? So that he was warned about that, okay? And now what does Bill Burns say? Well, the attack on Ukraine was unprovoked. It was unprovoked. Well, you know, here's Lavrov telling him in 2008, you're going to provoke us into intervening. And now Bill Burns has become a propagandist.
I would imagine you agree with just about all of that, Colonel.
Well, I think, unfortunately, all the top leadership in the military, the State Department, and the federal bureaucracy in general is compromised. We have to accept that fact. We've always had a problem with the senior officers who were, I would say, economical with the truth. But now we have people that are just not telling the truth.
You're being charitable. McGovern is saying that a four-star at the time, who's now the Secretary of Defense, was lying to the public and lying to his bosses and twisting the truth that CIA agents risked their lives to get.
We'll go back and bring up some old film footage of Generals Hertling and Petraeus Marty Dempsey, others talking about the high quality of the Iraqi army and its readiness to fight and how well prepared and well trained it was and so forth. This is not new. These people are being expected to support the party line because that's what the policymakers want. If you don't do that, if you don't want to do that, then you're not going to get promoted. You're not going to have those jobs. So you know, this is not really news. Ray McGovern is right. Now, Ray is wrong on something else, because I have had the privilege of listening to Mr. Lavrov in private, and his English is almost accent-free. It's extremely good. I wish that most of the people in the U.S. government spoke English as well as Mr. Lavrov does.
I'm going to have to play this little segment for the great Ray the next time he's on. He'll get a kick out of it. Colonel, are you surprised that Bakhmut has yet to fall?
Well, not really, because I think the Ukrainian leadership has vacillated between abandoning it as essentially a black hole for Ukrainian blood and treasure, and at the same time holding it against all odds for the purpose of demonstrating to their supporters in the West that they, quote unquote, can still win. They've been going back and forth on this for months. And I think the Russian position has been, we don't have to take this tomorrow morning. We don't have to take this next week. We're eventually going to have it. We're going to own it all. It's just a question of time. And if the Ukrainians want to commit tens of thousands of their soldiers to hold this place, well, come on in, take up a position. I watched a film just yesterday of a Ukrainian brigade trying to move forward in the Donbas, not far from Bakhmut, off the road. These were all dismounted infantrymen, large numbers of them. And the Russians who filmed this fired one artillery round into the midst of them, confirmed that they had it, and then essentially opened up with all the guns. Within a few minutes, virtually everyone in the brigade was annihilated. Mm. In other words, this intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance complex of platforms, everything from space down to ground level, now provides accurate and quick targeting data for the use of Russian artillery, Russian missiles, Russian rockets, and in the space of a minute or two, such that as Ukrainian formations move forward before they ever get a chance to close with the Russian enemy, they are taken under fire and largely annihilated.
Colonel, is it common for Russian forces, American forces, I don't know if the Ukrainians can do this, to film their destruction of the enemy in real time? Did you see this in real time?
No, I saw the film. It was shown to me on a video. In other words, it had been taken at the time of this event, and I don't know exactly where it was, but I know that it was real, and I know it was in the Donbas in eastern Ukraine. Do we do this sort of thing? Sure. I mean, you've seen gun camera footage from American attack helicopters that show people launching Hellfire missiles and rockets at Afghan or Iraqi insurgents, and you watch the missiles reach the targets, detonate, and kill everyone. So this is not unusual, and frequently it's done for higher headquarters to see how the effects of the weapons work. People want to know that what they're doing is working. Now, in this particular case, I think they were trying to demonstrate just how good the system they've built works. And the Russians have built a very effective system.
Colonel, I want to ask you a question that's a little political. And if you don't want to answer it, please to tell me. And I ask this with a lot of respect. Donald Trump has been arguing that if he were president, this war wouldn't be going on. You, of course, held a senior position in the Defense Department for part of President Trump's presidency. I think you know this. Some of us tried to talk him into appointing you as Secretary of Defense. Didn't happen. Maybe it'll happen in the future. But what would or could he have done, or what would you have advised him to do if President Putin began the special military operation under Donald Trump's watch?
Well, let's go back to your first question about Donald Trump had he been president. There is no doubt in my mind that President Trump would have picked up the phone and instantly called President Putin and asked him, what are you doing? Why are you doing it? And can we talk about this? In other words, if it had gone that far.
Right.
I think that probably President Trump would have talked to him earlier before he mobilized forces and moved them into Ukraine. Now, could he have prevented it? That's a difficult question simply because, remember, he had appointed large numbers of people who were not supportive of him, who actually subverted him. The general officers that produced the debacle at Kabul Airport when we left Afghanistan were the same general officers who were there when he was president. In other words, it's important for people to understand that his intentions were clear, unambiguous, and pure, no doubt about it. He was utterly opposed to war with Russia or China. His emphasis with China was always economic and business, never military. His emphasis with Russia was never on the military side. On contrary, he saw lots of room for cooperation and a coincidence of interest in a number of key areas. So he was unalterably opposed to conflict. But again, he had lots of people under him that, regardless of what he thought and said and did, took the opposite position. I mean, I sat there in the Oval Office and listened to it. People were absolutely insistent that, you know, we were going to face in the future, and already did, existential threats from China and Russia. So, you know, preventing it, maybe. Stopping it, maybe. But with all the trouble that he had on the Hill, you could look at the people on the Hill who are virtually, for the most part, the same actors that were there when he was president. You have the same generals in many cases. Some of them have turned over, certainly in the case of the Secretary of Defense, but they were all of one mind. We have to harm, fight, damage, hurt, use whatever verb you want, Russia.
Colonel, this is a brilliant, gifted, firsthand, and courageous answer, and I'm deeply grateful for it. I want to go back just for a moment before we finish to where we started. I'm still fascinated, just because of my general understanding, of some of which comes from you, of the way heads of state operate when they say things in public. This statement by President Xi, it's time to consider a ceasefire. Surely there's someone high up in the Pentagon or the State Department or the National Security Council who will say to someone north of that person, you know, this is very interesting. Let's consider it. Is there nobody in Joe Biden's realm that's going to say in here, Xi is sense. It's time to do something about talking, because this fight is not going to end the way you want it to end, Joe.
You know, this is a very important question. You know, first of all, if you go back to the Bay of Pigs operation, when President Kennedy was in the White House, he was not fully briefed on everything that was going on. And he was effectively presented the plan as a fait accompli. This is going to happen. We've got it all under control. Alan Dulles said, we're good to go. And he launched it without understanding its implications. He subsequently met with President Eisenhower, and President Eisenhower said, well, President Kennedy, with whom did you speak? And he said, well, I talked to the Secretary of Defense. I talked to the head of the CIA. I talked to one or two other people. And he said, well, that's not enough. There were other people you should have consulted with on the National Security Council, people who would have told you that you were walking into a bear trap. And now, ultimately, Kennedy acted to fire the head of the CIA. And he did not make that mistake again. That was a very costly mistake, obviously. We're lucky that we got out of it as easily as we did. It hurt a lot of people, unfortunately. I think you have a similar set of circumstances right now. People do not think these things through. They're not thoroughly planned. There's too much emotion, too much passion, not enough reason. There's no one who sits there and says, before we do anything, we should ask ourselves, what do we gain and what do we lose? Is the gain worth the loss? Now, that seems very simple, but people don't do it. And that's why President Trump's position was so vital and essential in June of 2019 when he was presented with a fait accompli. General McKenzie and CENTCOM had sent this global hawk on the outskirts of the air defense identification zone that belonged to Iran, right up the center of the Persian Gulf, knowing full well that the Iranians would probably shoot it down. And gosh, we had a strike package ready to go. Air Force, Army, missiles, everything you can think of, Navy, strike package ready to launch. And sure enough, they shot the Global Hawk down. And suddenly the entire joint staff descends upon the White House. The War Council is held. Sir, we're ready to launch the strike package. And Donald Trump sits there and says, well, why? Was this a manned aircraft? Was this a deliberate provocation? And he just went through and asked these questions. They said, well, it was unmanned. So you're telling me no one was hurt? No, no one was hurt. And how many people are we going to kill with this strike package that you want to put together? Well, they started adding up the numbers and they got up to a few hundred. And he said, then what happens? No, he said, no, it's over. I'm not going to do it. Thank you very much. But we know that Bolton at the time, the National Security Advisor, General McKenzie, I'm told Secretary of State Pompeo, they were all cheering, let's go, let's get this done. Finally, we get the war we want with Iran. So fortunately, he was there to say no. The problem now is that these things have taken on a life of their own. Did someone go to the president and say, we want to fly two B-52s over the Baltic within 50 nautical miles of St. Petersburg and practice the release of cruise missiles targeting Russia?
And expect the Russians to do nothing.
President, come on. I don't think anybody did. So who signed off on that one? Jake Sullivan? And remember, this relationship between the National Security Advisor and the president is a very important one. There is a memorandum, an executive order, if you will, that stipulates all the authorities that are devolved from the president to the National Security Advisor. These are things, much of which are classified. So they don't even need to go through the president. We don't know how that impacted this particular decision-making process. But this whole business is out of control. Someone at the helm should be holding the reins very tightly, making it abundantly clear what we will and will not do. All this nonsense about strategic ambiguity is a disaster. This is a time for absolute clarity. This is a time for the phone lines to burn up from Washington to Moscow immediately. It's not happening, Judge, and I'm worried.
On that, we'll finish for today. Colonel, thank you so much. We'll see you again soon, my dear friend.
Okay, thank you.
Boy, if you appreciate what we do, Like and subscribe. You'll see more of this brilliant and courageous colonel, Judge Napolitano, for Judging Freedom.